19. Assuming the U.S. personnel were able to communicate with this alien, Mark pointed out to me, why couldn't he tell them about their dietary needs? In view of their superior intelligence and as they had already been here for some time, they must have known what foodstuffs were available on Earth. My clear understanding from Robert was that it was a feeding problem as opposed to a disease or illness problem. A good question. I have learned a great deal, for instance, from Thomas, one of the hand-picked team that took care of two survivors from the Roswell incident for a considerable period of time, as part of an Anglo-American alien arrangement, Chapter 10. The injured aliens they cared for and communicated with extensively, via a type of telepathy, as in the two previous cases, seemed mostly capable of consuming their own liquid-based nutrients. Although some of Linda's information is at variance with that supplied to Sir Mark by her father, it does not, in my view, negate the essentials of the story. When dealing with sensitive information, it is as common for informants to deliberately alter some of the facts as it is for recipients sometimes to get their facts wrong. Anglo-American incidents. The village of Tarland lies some 25 miles west of Aberdeen, Scotland. In the summer of 1957, the Aberdeen Division of the Territorial Army, TAR, had chosen this area, which included much densely wooded terrain, for an exercise. The following report was supplied to me by researcher Ian Taylor. At around 4 o'clock, two young recruits from the main force heard what they thought were the advancing enemy coming toward their position through the trees. Armed and ready in their trench for a surprise attack, they suddenly heard strange, guttural-like voices and the cracking of twigs as though people were breaking them underfoot. What happened next threw the men into a state of abject panic. They saw two human-like figures coming toward them that seemed to be around 7 to 8 feet in height, wearing what they described to be very tight-fitting, one-piece silvery-colored garments. The guttural-like sounds they first heard were in fact some form of dialogue between these entities. The soldiers jumped up from their positions and took off in the opposite direction toward the roadway. They continued to run, still in a state of panic. Then, just above the tree line close to the Tarland roadway, a large and glowing disc-like object of intense brightness appeared overhead, showering down what looked like sparks. The object appeared to follow them as they ran, and then rapidly overtook them and shot skyward. One of the men collapsed from exhaustion and lay at the side of the road while his colleague continued to run, eventually reaching a post office line engineer in a roadside trailer. The soldier apparently hammered on the door for help. Eventually the two men returned to fetch the other soldier and brought him to the trailer to recover. The press carried an article a couple of days later, but in no great detail. Following the article, the two young TAR recruits had been interviewed by personnel who had traveled up from Whitehall in London. I can recall years later someone who claimed he knew one of the soldiers, who said they had been given instructions to maintain a vow of silence over the event. 20. Harold Varnam, the British Army veteran cited earlier in connection with the indoctrination film shown at the Karlsruhe Air Base, Germany, also sent me his report of an encounter with a definite foreign object. An incident which occurred in June of either 1971 or 72 while he was participating in an exercise at the Stanford Battle Area, better known as the Stanford Training Area, Stanta, located in the county of Norfolk. Our small unit of the Army Emergency Reserve, EOR, was under the auspices of NATO, and we usually did our annual 15-day main exercise on the Lüneburgheide, a large area of heath and woodland in northern Germany, attached to the 4th Armored Division, his narrative begins. Sometimes we went further afield to Canada, Cyprus, or Kenya, etc. But for some reason, on this particular year we joined the scheme in Norfolk. It was an extended NATO exercise covering most of the European theater and had been going for some time when we joined it. I believe the exercise was coded Green Sword, which was conducted in two phases, Green Sword I and Green Sword II. Our phase, Green Sword I, was more of a search and evasion exercise and was infantry-based, although there was artillery and aircraft support. At the first briefing there were groans of dismay when we were told that it would be a live firing exercise, and then sighs of relief when we were told that although the scheme was being run by the U.S. 5th Army, the live firing would be the responsibility of 2nd Coldstreams, whose motto was Nihil Secundus, second to none. We knew that the disciplined guards would ensure that accidents, always inevitable, would be kept to a minimum. Our unit's 4-man night patrols were tasked with our usual role of observation and reconnaissance, but we were given free rein to harass the enemy whenever targets of opportunity arose. The weather was splendid, and to tell the truth, it never really got properly dark. On the night of the incident, which we think was a Thursday, Friday, our own patrol had split into two pairs as we approached our designated target. My partner, a man who I will refer to as Lang Jan, named after a church steeple on the island of Walcheren, one of the highest points in Holland, was very popular with the Dutch Kriegsmarine commando who we trained with, and they had bestowed that nickname on him. As we approached our target area, a very bright light appeared on the horizon. It looked at first like huge car headlights, but this was very unusual as, apart from the odd traces and flares, the battlefield was almost always in darkness. Then suddenly, and I do mean instantaneously, the light was immediately to our front, probably some 3 miles away. The only way I can describe this light is to call it blue-white, rather like that given off by the new LED bulbs, only very much brighter. Then we realized a peculiar thing: the light did not radiate, it simply seemed to be self-contained, and appeared to either be hovering over, or in, a wooded area in our target zone. We decided to take a closer look. Lang Jan, originally out of 1 Para, 1st Battalion of the Parachute Regiment, was the best field soldier I ever knew, and he had the ability to almost merge with any terrain, but nevertheless after a stealthy 1,000 yards or so we were bumped by an American patrol who told us that this area was now out of bounds. Undeterred, we tried again, but when we were stopped a second time by a very jumpy officer, extremely nervous, and told in no uncertain terms that we had to leave, we decided to let it go. As it was already becoming daylight in the east, we started to head back to our lines when instantly the light went out, just as if someone had thrown a switch. But we could clearly see fires burning in the wooded area and what looked like considerable damage to the trees and undergrowth, although there was no sign of debris. At the next morning's O Group debriefing session, we learned that only 2 of our patrols had seen the strange light, but when we brought it up an intelligence officer said that a Phantom jet had crashed and the area was now off limits for the rest of the exercise. The Phantoms, operating out of Laeken Heath, had indeed been taking part in the scheme, doing low-level mock strafing and bombing runs, and terrifying they were too. But I had previously served in the Royal Air Force in air, surface movements, what would now be called the dispatcher, and had seen firsthand some plane crashes, and the incident in the woods did not resemble in any way a normal air crash. But that was the end of the matter, it never came up again. Generous as ever, the Americans allowed us the use of the facilities at RAF, Alconbury, the PX stores, hypermarkets where one could purchase an almost unbelievable range of goods at very competitive prices, and the Rod and Gun Club lounge, when we were on stand down. In the club the following day, we brought up the subject of the downed plane, but no one seemed to know anything about it, or if they did, they were playing tight-lipped. After debriefing and release on the Saturday, we decided once more to take a look for ourselves at the site. At the time, Lang Jan had a long wheelbase Land Rover, and so 6 of us got aboard and we headed for the crash site. But this time it was heavily cordoned off and we could not get really close, but we did have field glasses and we could clearly see the scorched area of the wood, which looked as though a road had been carved through it, maybe some 70 or 80 yards wide. Since we were attracting unwarranted attention, we decided to scoot. Since that day, I had never really thought about it. Only some local interest in a UFO incident brought back the memories of that night in Norfolk. 21, on the night of May 23/24, 1974, men of the U.S. Army's 4th Platoon, Bravo Company, B Battalion, 2nd Regiment of the 32nd Air Defense Command were deployed in a mountain pass northeast of Ramstein Air Force Base, Germany. 1st Lieutenant Robert Cardini was the 4th platoon leader and Captain Michael J. Stack was commanding Bravo Company. The soldiers had been told they were on special duty owing to Russian and/or Warsaw Pact forces testing American radar defenses. The men were surprised that live ammunition for the Vulcan 20mm cannons and live Chaparral anti-aircraft missiles were to be utilized. Lieutenant Cardini gave orders to the crews of the cannons to load canisters of live high-explosive phosphorus rounds and to maintain high alert. At about 045, Lieutenant Cardini gave orders that something hostile was incoming and that the gunners were to shoot down anything coming through the pass, stating that since no friendlies would be flying below 2,700 feet, anything else was to be shot down. At around 1 o'clock, a Sergeant Jontz noticed a fast approaching, zigzagging, flattened ellipsoid-shaped craft with rounded edges, about 30 feet long and glowing with a silvery iridescence. It took a few seconds for Sergeant Jontz's cannon's computer and a Doppler radar to calculate a precise speed, range, and direction of travel and to achieve a lock-on, report said Comack, an American researcher who received the report anonymously, via mail. When the cannon locked onto the object through the reticulated gun sights, he began firing, first a few rounds for effect and then 3 4-second bursts of 110 rounds each into the side of the object. Sergeant Jontz was almost at eye level with the object as he watched his rounds pouring into its sides. He was expecting to see the blooming flower effect of the phosphorus rounds exploding, but he did not. It was as if the shells are being absorbed or being vaporized by some sort of force field, Jontz said, which was quite remarkable containment of shells having a 35-meter kill radius. Meanwhile, on the mountainside, Sergeant William McCracken, inside the launch control console of a Chaparral battery, locked onto a target and fired a missile, which climbed to about 900 feet, located the object, moved close ahead of the target, and detonated. Gunners and observers watched as the target started wobbling, then stopped, forward motion and finally wobbled downward to the valley floor in what the observers believed was a controlled descent. U.S. Air Force personnel later secured this crash landing site. According to Comack's source, various Air Force personnel, including a Major Mike Andrews, pseudonym, and 3 Army officers from the Army Vulnerability Assessment Laboratory in Alamogordo's, New Mexico, were flown in a C-141 Starlifter transport Ramstein. The soldiers who had had a direct active part in the mission less than 12 hours earlier met individually with the debriefers, Comack's report continues. The 3 Army officers handled the first debriefing, followed by groups of Air Force officers, who warned the men that if they ever told anyone about what they had imagined had happened, they would never work for the government, and warned of unspecified dire things that would happen to them should they ever talk. The men were required to sign a security oath to never divulge the details of that night, and, if questioned in the future, to deny that it ever happened. On the afternoon of May 25, Major Andrews and his crew were told to report to their aircraft, parked at a remote location on the Ramstein Air Base, and he was shocked to note that a set of metal supports had been constructed on the wings and fuselage of his C-141, attached to which was something large and ellipsoid, covered with olive drab green canvas tarpaulins. During preparations for takeoff, Andrews noted the minimal fuel load, due to the weight of the additional craft. On reaching its cruise altitude, the C-141 was refueled by a KC-135 tanker. Major Andrews's orders were that he was not to land until he reached Wright-Patterson AFB, and that he would be met by refueling tankers at strategic points across the Atlantic, Ed Comack learned. It was dark in Ohio when Major Andrews landed to disembark the airmen, all but 4 who were to remain aboard and who then were carrying M16 rifles in addition to their sidearms. The pilots and crew of the C-141 were not allowed out of the plane and they did not refuel. Taking off again with a minimal fuel load, They were once again met at altitude by another KC-135 tanker and flew on direct to Nellis AFB, Nevada, where the crew was once again not allowed outside the aircraft as their wingtip cargo was offloaded and taken away, again covered completely. On returning to Maguire AFB, New Jersey, Andrews and his crew were debriefed by an Air Force colonel who warned them never to discuss the mission with anyone. Another source present during the downing of the craft pointed out to Comac that, although he had observed the incident, there were no mountains northeast of Ramstein, only hills. However, although this informant did not witness the May 23/24 attack per se, he believes he did see the crashing object looking like it was dripping iridescent white fire. He also claims that a couple of weeks earlier another unknown craft was almost hit by a Nike missile, whereupon it started flying erratically, then two F-4s, Phantom jets, came and gave chase, disappearing beyond the ridges. Don't know if they got that one, but the base went on full alert. We were anticipating the Russians to be coming, not the spacemen. 22. The Secret Team. In 1994 I had the privilege on two occasions of interviewing L. Fletcher Putty, a retired U.S. Air Force colonel, cited earlier, in Washington, D.C. a former fighter pilot and professor of air science and tactics at Yale University. He was also directly in charge of the global system designed to provide military support for the clandestine activities of the CIA. Regarding the UFO subject, Putty revealed a hitherto top-secret report he had investigated in 1953-54 relating to the observation of a large unknown craft which based a C-54 military transport plane over the Pacific Ocean for over an hour, witnessed by the entire crew and passengers. His report appears in two of my books. 23. All CIA military activities were channeled through Putty. Not being a CIA man, per se, he was exempt from taking the oath of secrecy. And being the focal point officer placed him in a very privileged position. In effect, states the publisher's blurb to The Secret Team, one of two of his books he gave me, Putty was far more knowledge of CIA activities than almost all members of that organization. The subtitle does not mince its words, the CIA and its allies in control of the United States and the world. Like it or not, he wrote in a preface to the second edition in 1990, we now live in a new age of one world. This is the age of global companies, of global communications and transport, of global finance and, just around the corner, global accommodation of political systems. It is time to face the fact that true national sovereignty no longer exists. We live in a world of big business, big lawyers, big bankers, even bigger moneymen and big politics. It is the world of the Secret Team. In such a world, the Secret Team is a dominant power. It is neither military nor police. It is covert, and the best, or worst, of both. It gets the job done whether it has political authorization and direction or not. It is independent. It is lawless. This book is based upon personal experience generally derived from work in the Pentagon from 1955 to 1964. At retirement, I was Chief of Special Operations, Clandestine Activities, with the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff. These duties involved the military support of the clandestine activities of the CIA and were performed under the provisions of National Security Council Directive No. 5412/2. He continues, I was the first author to point out that the CIA's most important cover story is that of an intelligence agency. Of course, the CIA does make use of intelligence and intelligence gathering, but that is largely a front for its primary interest. Fun and games. The CIA is the center of a vast mechanism that specializes in covert operations. In this sense, the CIA is the willing tool of a higher-level secret team, or high cabal, that usually includes representatives of the CIA and other instrumentalities of the government, certain cells of the business and professional world and, almost always, foreign participation. It is this secret team. 24, at the heart of the team. Of course, are a handful of top executives of the CIA and of the National Security Council, NSC, most notably the chief White House advisor to the president regarding foreign policy affairs. Around them revolves a sort of inner ring of presidential officials, civilians, and military men from the Pentagon, and career professionals in the intelligence community. It is often quite difficult to tell exactly who many of these men really are, because some may wear a uniform and the rank of general and really be with the CIA, and others may be as inconspicuous as the executive assistant to some cabinet officer's chief deputy. Out beyond this ring is an extensive and intricate network of government officials with responsibility for, or expertise in, some specific field that touches on national security or foreign affairs, think tank analysts, businessmen who travel a lot or whose businesses, for example, import-export or cargo airline operations, are useful, academic experts in this or that technical subject or geographic region, and quite importantly, alumni of the intelligence community, a service from which there are no unconditional resignations. 25. Sponsored by President Truman and established by an act of Congress, summarizes the publisher's blurb for The Secret Team. The CIA was initially founded as a data coordinating, intelligence gathering agency to help fight the Cold War. But its profile today is unrecognizable, and its power is unstoppable. The President of the United States is impotent against it, Congress cannot legislate it, the military cannot corral it, and the public doesn't even know about it. Regarding the CIA UFO debunking program, in October 1994 I had the pleasure of spending a day in the delightful company of Frederick C. Durant III, a former U.S. Naval Reserve pilot who was on the CIA's Office of Scientific Intelligence Advisory Panel convened in January 1953 to discuss methods of debunking the subject. Its final report is commonly known as the Durant Report. We subsequently corresponded regularly. While continuing to toe the line, a note he sent me in March 2007 was encouraging: "Hi, good friend. Never, never, ever give up. A tight lid." The US government and the British have made secret treaty agreements with the aliens in exchange for technology and so-called recommissions during times of human conflict, claims an anonymous three-star general. The aliens have basically agreed not to concern themselves with the wars or conflicts of humans, not to interfere in society. Let the governments rule and decide. Exactly what the aliens get in return was not exactly made clear or available. Also, there are special teams which eradicate, discredit, harass, and trump up charges to control humans who experience any visitations from aliens, or make verifiable UFO sightings. This is one of the reasons I retired. 26. William J. Porlek, the former U.S. Air Force Computer Operations and Programming Specialist cited in Chapter 14, confirms some of the above. I would say this is international in scope. He told Stephen Greer of the Disclosure Project, in an interview, that Porlek had specified not to be released until December 2010. The projects that we have are closely tied in with other allies' governments. In fact, I have been told back in the late 1970s, on one of the early classified projects I worked on, that there was a secret agreement between us and the Brits, so whatever we invent, they get. And there is no limitation as to what it is. The Brits can make their duplicates, and we don't hold back on any of the technology, because of that secret agreement that was cut during World War II. And we have other allies like that. I believe that what we see also is a lot of cross-pollination of scientists from different countries working on projects even in the most classified arenas in the United States. Porlek also hinted that certain British commando units liaise with their American counterparts on the problem, as for example in the 1971-72 incident described earlier by Harold Varnam. All these black projects were highly classified. What concerns me, he continued, is when these projects go beyond black, people with ulterior motives that have gotten in control of these projects and or the funding for them, and or the ability of what really is scary, to write their own unlimited checks with no recourse to anybody. They're not even a budget item anymore. They literally authorize the Treasury to cut them checks, and, it becomes evident that they have agendas that are independent of the goals of the United States. And the attitude is seemingly one of control, power and control. The ability of certain forces out there to use force whenever absolutely necessary, or other controlling mechanism to ameliorate the danger of a leak, or maintain secrecy with fear, is always there. If they can do one high-profile hit on somebody in a specific way, what it does is put the fear of God into those that they want to continue to control, so that they don't say anything out of turn, they don't probe where they shouldn't probe, like Congressman Stephen Siff was doing. 27. My concerns are for the freedom of our country, and of the free world. It sounds rather simplistic, but we have a philosophy upon which we base our lives, and my philosophy is the Republican form of government, if we can get back to it in some way, shape or form, which is the strongest form of government developed by man. If we don't find ways to neutralize these negative forces, we're going to find our lifestyles, our concepts of life as a species, nullified. 28. As Dwight D. Eisenhower had warned in his farewell speech as president in January 1961, in the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. 29. That scenario of a satellite government has long since arrived. In their book AD After Disclosure, Richard Dolan and Bryce Zabel refer to it as the breakaway group. Bolstered by tremendous co-opted assets worldwide, they claim, they have over the years gained tremendous independence from the established political and military authorities. For it is likely that this breakaway group answers not so much to the President of the United States as it does toward powerful, private, internationally based individuals and groups. 30. Dolan and Zabel also cite the research by Dr. Richard Sodder into massive, deep, clandestine bases and tunnels, including those beneath our seabeds, plans of which were initiated by the U.S. National Security Establishment in the 1960s. 31. And according to Dolan and Zabel, an assistant secretary to a branch of the armed forces told a family friend that he had been briefed for some 8 weeks at an underground facility outside of Washington. Asked the purpose of the briefing, this highly placed man, who went on to become a cabinet secretary, said, "There is intelligent life in the universe, it's here. And I've seen it." The cabinet secretary told the family friend that aliens were just the tip of the iceberg in terms of mind-blowing revelations. 32, Chapter 19. What on earth? Earlier, I revealed information pertaining to an alien technology transfer program provided for me by a U.S. Army intelligence veteran, a senior aerospace reporter based in the Washington, D.C. area. He, in turn, acquired that knowledge from a high-ranking source at the Pentagon in the USAF Air Staff and Joint Staff in the 1980s. If what my source has learned about the alien presence on Earth is true, it supports Dr. David Jacobs's contention that a hybridization program poses a serious threat to humankind. The following scenario is based on some new information relating to Project Aquarius, acquired more recently from my source relating to a particular species, probably the predominant group, involved in the abduction program. I shall also touch on some of the material first revealed in Unearthly Disclosure. As to what is happening currently, I have no idea, apart from the information supplied to me by Maria Rivera. The creatures have had a long-term plan to create a race of alien-human hybrids, purportedly to make us more peaceful. Their true purpose, however, is to create a passive human race, incapable of violence, by eradicating the human emotions that enable us to survive, thus laying us open to conquest. However, if this has been a long-term stratagem, I've yet to see much evidence of the human race becoming less violent. In any event, these particular aliens are not omnipotent, and to a certain extent feared us. Although possessing a type of handheld weapon, some of them had been killed by our military. A number of their bases were guarded by elements of the U.S. military. Compartmentalization within Project Aquarius was extreme. a select cell within the army, for example, worked with other security cells in the Air Force and Navy. Around 100 personnel from the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, AFOSI, were involved.